Ms. Armstrong, you may proceed. You're in an interesting position here. You can simply say, I'll rest on my brief. You can say, I'll answer any questions you'd like, or you can talk to us for 15 minutes.
I'm going to try to not use the 15 minutes, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. Alice Armstrong on behalf of the Commonwealth. Your Honor, the Commonwealth submits that the Court of Appeals correctly concluded that the assignment of error in this case was insufficient under Rule 5A12C and appropriately dismissed the case. I assume that the Court does have questions for me regarding the sufficiency of the assignment of error, but I would observe to the Court that even under Findley, this is insufficient because this is the bare-bones allegation that the evidence was insufficient. It does not point to a motion. It does not point to any other preliminary ruling. It says the judge got it wrong under the evidence.
But doesn't it say the judge got it wrong because of the testimony of these two people don't support the conclusion
of
the judge?
It says that, but it doesn't say what element of the offenses was not satisfied. It lumps the two offenses together and just says no reasonable fact finder could have possibly reached this conclusion.
Are you asking us to say it shouldn't say the court erred because? Because we've addressed that. We said you don't have to say because. And I know there's a lot of disagreement with that position.
Well, two things. I would respectfully ask the court to reconsider Findley and Amin and Herring.
Herring, yeah.
Because those three cases essentially eviscerate more than 100 years of this court's jurisprudence. This court has said that you have to lay, that the appellant must lay his finger on the error, not on the ruling, on the error that the court made. How was the court wrong? And I would respectfully suggest that because is not necessary. So a proper assignment of error in Findley would have been the trial court erred in determining that his consent was voluntary. That's not a because. Yes, Ron?
As you may have guessed, I have a particular affinity for Findley.
I do understand that, Your Honor.
Has a particular affinity for
Herring. I understand that.
So in your remaining 13 minutes and 3 seconds, we may want to talk ever so briefly about the other assignment of error, and I presume your position is that the evidence was sufficient, and so therefore whether the assignment of error was proper or not, there was sufficient evidence adduced at the trial for this conviction. Would that be your position?
That is my position, but before we get to that, Your Honor, my position is that that's not properly before the court either under Rule 5:25.
Okay.
Because the motion to strike, the only thing that was challenged in the motion to strike, was the evidence sufficient to establish intent for the originally charged offense of unlawful wounding. He was actually convicted of the lesser included offense, which has no intent element. So there was no challenge at all in the trial court to the sufficiency of the evidence for either of the crimes of conviction. There was actually no motion to strike whatsoever to the destruction of property.
Well, can I agree with you about that? That's the end of the case, isn't it?
It's the end of the case.
That you want to
it's not the end of the well, Your Honor, I was reluctant. I was invited to waive argument. I assumed the court would have questions of me, and so I would like to address the court's questions.
So you would rather win the war than just the battle.
Well, I feel like the battle-hardened veteran of what I like to refer to as the 5A12C wars, Your Honor. And I do understand the court, and I understand who I'm speaking to. I also, though, again, as we discussed when I was here about a year ago in the Eggleston case, there are institutional concerns here. And I heard the court this morning. I do listen carefully always when the court is addressing us. I heard the court admonish the new admittees to the bar to strive for excellence in the pursuit of our profession. And I would respectfully say to the court that watering down these rules, that permitting something less than excellence, it doesn't promote excellence in our profession. It doesn't raise the standard of litigation, and I respectfully suggest to this court that it's not helpful to this court or to the Court of Appeals for the court to have to do the work to mine through these records to determine what people are actually complaining about. The settled jurisprudence of this court before the rule change, and even in light of Davis, was very specific and exact, and it said you had to lay your finger on what the court got wrong, not that you were unhappy with the judgment, the nature of the court's mistake so that we can all focus our attentions and energies on the mistake. Litigation always, and I think all the rules of this court and of appellate procedure, is to narrow the issues that are before the court. I know this court sometimes asks us for concessions to narrow the issues before the court. That is the purpose of the assignment of error rule, to get everyone directed, to get all of the attention focused on the issue at hand.
Well, counsel, let me ask you a question, and yes. I don't mean to repeat what Justice Millett said, but why doesn't the assignment of error, that does specifically direct us to, in reviewing it, to James Mulberry's testimony as well as Deputy Donald Smith, send us to where this litigant, this attorney representing a client, believes that the trial court erred in not convicting this individual?
I have two answers. One, I guess, more institutional and one specific to this case. Institutionally, it still requires this court not to... It still requires this court to dig into the record, to really identify or ferret
out.
But
isn't that the purpose of the argument? Why would we have to have any briefing in an argument section if it all was laid out in the had to be laid out in the assignment of error?
Well, I think what the assignment of error does is what the argument does is explicate the point. So it lays out the rule of law that we're relying on to make the point that there was an error, or for me to defend the point that there was not an error. But to answer the question more specifically with respect to this case, when you look at the testimony of those two witnesses, it does nothing to negate that there was a battery in this case.
Well, that is an issue that we would decide in resolving whether or not there was error. But it does point us to at least what this litigant, what this attorney, believes was the problem with the case, the weakness in the conviction.
I have to respectfully disagree, because it does not illuminate what it was about their testimony that made it unreasonable, or that made it such that no reasonable fact finder could have possibly found the defendant guilty of a battery. It does not illuminate the issue. It's still a broad criticism of the judgment the trial court reached. I think even under Findley, it's insufficient, because this is the broad criticism.
Counsel, I have one more question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
And I certainly respect and agree with your comments reflecting the Chief Justice's comments on the need for excellence and competence and good representation. But isn't part of that also, part of our concern also, that clients be able to be heard on their appeals when they are within reasonably identifiable compliance with the rules? Because the individual hurt in any case like this would not be the attorney. It is ultimately the person seeking access to justice.
And again, let me give a two-part answer. One is, at least with respect to criminal defendants, and I know that some members of this court have heard this before, specifically when we argued Eggleston, it's actually a better disposition for the criminal defendant to be dismissed, because then he has a statutory remedy that allows him to have his appeal reinstated. Essentially, as a matter of right and routine, our office does not contest those motions when it is clear that there was a procedural dismissal. But
would your office not contest a motion for a habeas corpus because of the ineffective assignments of error?
We absolutely contest those. We contest those all the time, because when the claim is my attorney was ineffective because he blew my appeal, that's essentially how it is presented, he has to show Strickland prejudice. We absolutely contest
those. So it's somewhat of a questionable alternative. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, I'm saying if the court wants a criminal defendant to have the opportunity to come into court and have the court consider his claims on the merits, it's better for him to get a new attorney, come back with proper assignments of error, and have the court consider the merits of the case. Because what happens when we have these kinds of assignments of error is that there are frequently waivers, there are frequently 5:25 types of problems, and then he's procedurally defaulted when he gets to federal court. Nobody really considers the merits of these things. So if the court's institutional concern is to have the merits considered, I respectfully suggest to the court that it is better to require all litigants to pursue excellence in bringing these cases to the courts. And there was another point I wanted to make, and I've lost it now because I told you there were going to be
well,
two parts to my answer.
Here.
I apologize. But I also would make this observation to the court. It doesn't promote excellence in my litigation to this court when I have to guess what we're talking about. I would observe to the court that since Moore versus the Commonwealth was handed down, although the rules provide for it, there has not been one single case where anybody from my division has rewritten an assignment of error for fear that we will be caught in the trap, that we have waived something by trying to present to this court the proper way to review the case. And I know that that's maybe another day's problem or another day's concern, but I would just ask the court respectfully to take a step back and to reconsider what's going on here as an institutional matter, and to reconsider the effect of the holding in Findley and Herring, that it's not promoting excellence in our profession. I don't think it's helpful to the court. And I'm not sure.
Can I ask you one additional question? In this case, for example, apparently the argument is that the evidence presented by the two witnesses was not sufficient for the conviction that was obtained. Certainly, you knew that as soon as the brief was presented to you. Just because you don't know the detail at the assignment of error stage, how are you prejudiced that you can't have excellent work?
Well, I just would say that it leaves things open to the court. I mean, we're in a situation in the Court of Appeals where apparently in some situations people can amend their assignments of error at the bar of the court. That doesn't promote excellence.
No, that I can't argue that.
I mean, I can't respond to things that I hear from, well, maybe I can. Maybe I can't. But it would probably be an off-the-cuff response to whatever is happening.
But this is not off-the-cuff because you've had the brief and you know what their argument is. And if they don't put it in the argument, they've waived it, right?
Well, but part of the problem is I actually don't know, and it's actually not borne out in the argument. I don't know if he's saying that something that they testified to negated an element of the offense. I presume that's what he means, but I don't know that because he hasn't said what elements of the offense were not satisfied. I don't know if what he's saying is because of their testimony, the victim, he doesn't address the victim or the other witnesses at all. I don't know if he's saying their testimony meant that the other person's testimony was inherently incredible. So I do
have
to
guess.
Are you
saying all of that needs to be in the assignment of error?
No, I'm saying what the assignment of error needs to do is point me to the nature, to what element of the offense was not satisfied. I don't need to know. I can read what the witnesses said, so identifying a witness actually doesn't help me identify what the complaint is about the manner in which the evidence was insufficient. I actually don't know.
But why doesn't the brief tell you that, though?
Well, it just, I mean,
if it doesn't, then you would say that it's been waived.
We've read the brief, and what I'm saying is the balance of the record evidence makes plain that the trial court was correct, that there was a reasonable trier of fact could reach the conclusion that the trial court reached. I mean, beyond that, I have read the appendix, and I can say it's 525. There's a 525 problem, but prior to the rule change in this change in jurisprudence, it was very clear what was required in an assignment of error.
Well, but counsel, isn't that basically appellee's attorneys always that's their job as an attorney to take the assignments of error that have some meat to them, and there is something more in this one. We're talking about this case, and to read the briefs and to determine how you want to respond to it. Now, it's true, if an argument isn't made, you can say that it was waived, but that's your job, too. It's not just the job of the...
It absolutely is my job, and I always try to demean myself and to do as thorough a job as I'm capable of doing. What I'm saying, though, is that it leaves the door open to me being sandbagged when I get up here because I don't know if what he's saying is inherently incredible or some other thing. It's not in his brief. I know the court has read the briefs. It's not in there. There's not an explanation for it.
That is a separate question than the question we're talking about here, isn't
well,
it? I mean, other than your 525 argument, I understand that, but...
Yes. Well,
we're talking
I would
about
say,
just to what extent... How many pages do the assignments of error have to fill?
I don't think they have... The trial court erred in determining that the Commonwealth had satisfied the requirement that there was an offensive touching in this case. That's actually probably shorter than what he has. But it makes plain what the nature of the complaint is. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm over time. May I say one final point? I understand.
Say what?
May I say one final point?
Absolutely. Go right
ahead. Thank you, Your Honor. I think part of the difficulty here is that we're focused on the appellants, but they're only half, 50% of the litigants that this court sees. The appellee has a right to know what he's being called upon to answer for, and the appellee also has a right to rely on the rules this court said in Gim, as recently as in Gim Shuli. That the right to know when the litigation is over is a valuable right, and the appellee comes into the Court of Appeals and into this court standing on a presumptively valid judgment that we should be permitted to rely upon. And under all of those circumstances, Your Honors, and for all of the reasons that I understand, I ask the court to affirm.
Your Honor, Mr. Chief Justice, being sufficiently admonished, I would point out the appellee was excellently represented today.
Thank you.
Ms. Armstrong, my colleagues and I have often told the members of the bar they should never be afraid to tell the court they think we were wrong, as long as they do it in the right manner. You're clearly not afraid to tell us, and you've done it in the right manner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Call the next case.